Good evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, May 30th, 2016. South Sudan plans to dramatically ramp up its oil production by July.
We are now working to increase the production this Monday, and we are working to see the challenges so that we could stop.
And Sudan signs a preliminary deal with China to build a nuclear power plant.
For peaceful utilization of nuclear power is not prohibited, and it is under the complete regulations of the international agency.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's petroleum minister says the government is working to boost oil production from 120,000 barrels per day up to 300,000 barrels a day by July. Minister Doc Duop says oil production dropped significantly because of the conflict. Gift Friday reports for VOA from Juba.
Petroleum Minister Dishok says oil production, which South Sudan depends on 98% of its budget, plummeted during the fighting. And when all oil fields in the former Unity State, as well as a few others in the former Upper Nile State, were shut down.
At the moment, the oil production is 120, 130 in public. This is the production up to today. We are now working to increase the production and we are working to see the challenges so that we will resolve.
Bishok says engineers hired by the Petroleum Ministry are repairing the damage caused to South Sudan's oil infrastructure by government and rebel forces during the two-year conflict. He says, with relative peace across the country, the ministry plans to resume production in Unity State within a few months, possibly as early as July. It would supplement production in the Paloj oil fields in Upper Nile, the only functioning oil fields in the country. Bishok says government officials are in talks with various international oil companies to see how production can be increased.
We talked to those of companies who are shareholders, Nilepat and VPOC and SPOC and EPOC. So we talked to them. Then they agree that they will see into challenges and resolve them. By July, they will increase the production.
Bishok says the oil fields were badly damaged during the fighting and the resources are needed to resume the work of two oil refineries in the former states of Unity and Upper Nile.
When there is a crisis, everything has become damaged. We are now preparing to resume in oil field companies in Parjas and in Unity oil field. Our security elements are in the ground. And we are now preparing to go to the field to resume the work in oil field in the United States and also Sargas. Production is only one place, is in Paloj Malut area.
The refineries were still being built when conflict broke out in 2013. Last month, South Sudan's warring parties formed a transitional government of national unity to turn around the country's economic crisis and begin the healing process. The conflict has left tens of thousands of people dead and forced 2 million others to flee their homes. For VOA News, I'm Gift Friday in Juba.
Sudan and China have signed a framework agreement last week in Khartoum that, if implemented, will enable Sudan to build the first nuclear power plant in the country. Sudanese government officials say the nuclear reactor is intended to be used for peaceful purposes only. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Sudan government spokesperson Ahmed Bilal says his government signed the preliminary deal with China because the country is facing power shortages and is looking for safe, efficient alternative sources of energy.
We have a very actually constricted need for a constricted now situation, and we are in need for power. And I think for peaceful utilization of nuclear power is not prohibited, and it is under the complete regulations of the international agency.
Bilal says plans to build a nuclear power plant in Sudan are still in their initial phases and that more follow-up agreements will have to be concluded in order for a nuclear power plant to become a reality. He says the project will not be launched until all preparations and safety regulations are met.
Underdeveloped countries, when they go for this, they need some time, they need training, they need the know-how and many things actually. After all the requirements is ready and suitable, then you go for that. It's just an agreement, a framework agreement, and forward in our cooperation with China, we might reach the situation when we can start the project.
Haj Hamad, Executive Director at the Social and Human Development Consultative Group, says neither China nor Sudan is both responsible and capable of handling such dangerous and sophisticated technology safely.
Does it look responsible? You give such kind of technology for a poorly prepared country like Sudan. Maybe a small reactor that you know, you need for research, for production of medical supplies. So something like this might be more logical to Sudan, and then it will be useful to train personnel and develop the thinking in itself of how to cater for a highly radioactive material.
Hamad says the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is the global watchdog of safe nuclear energy, should closely monitor the China-Sudan nuclear agreement. He says one major concern for the Sudanese people and the international community at large is the safe and responsible handling of nuclear waste produced by a power plant of this magnitude.
The international community should help China not to put such kind of market interest over international security. Radiation is a borderless type of problem, and it is toxic for every in every direction. So surely the International Atomic Organization should be careful about such kind of deals.
Sudan's Ministry of Energy and Mines initiated a nuclear power program in 2007. And in 2010, the country started considering the feasibility of a nuclear power plant. In July 2015, the government's Geological Research Authority said that uranium exploration was a high priority and that any mining would be undertaken by Russian companies. Sudan is under economic and technological sanctions imposed by the United States since the country was listed as a state sponsor of terrorism in the late 1990s. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan celebrated yesterday's International Day of United Nations Peacekeepers in Torit today. The ceremony honored the heroes who died while serving as UN peacekeepers around the world. Kaltima Vanessa reports for VOA from Torit.
The occasion was attended by the state governor, the mayor, and deputy speaker of the state parliament, along with several state ministers. Mary Kamis, head of the UNMISS office in Torit, says despite continued insecurity in parts of South Sudan, UNMISS will continue to support the South Sudanese people.
The UNMISS peacekeepers and staff believe it is worth spending our energy and our passion for the people of South Sudan and for the peace, stability, and human dignity of the people. UNMISS peacekeeping soldiers and staff, whether civilian or military, are proud of our work and our contribution, and we believe what we do is worthwhile in this mission.
Imotong State Governor Natricia Loluken Manir says UNMISS has done a superb job of protecting the lives of South Sudanese residing in internally displaced camps across the country.
Regarding the 200,000 South Sudanese who are in camps internally, we also want to thank and register our gratitude to the UN peacekeepers and the UN body in general for keeping these lives. I know it has not been easy, especially following the incident of 2013. And we want to acknowledge your role in protecting our lives, especially the most vulnerable people women, and children.
Natricia says some UNMISS peacekeepers lost their lives trying to protect the civilians who were attacked at the UN base in Akobo in 2013. Natricia also asked the World Food Program to come to the aid of thousands of residents who do not have enough food.
This state has experienced hunger. It is a two-year hunger. Starting from last year until today, we have exhausted most of our coping mechanisms. All the yams, the wild plants, we have eaten them to survive. And therefore, I urge the WFP to speed the delivery of the 5,000 metric tons which were designated to our state.
UNMISS appealed to the people of the state to make effort to reconcile with each other, saying South Sudanese must learn to coexist peacefully. UNMISS says UNMISS will continue its work in South Sudan to see that peace, stability, and prosperity returns to the country. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa in Torit.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese women learn new skills that allow them to sell their work in the marketplace. Stay tuned.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you more of a coffee or tea person?
I'm more of a coffee person. No, I love coffee. Because sometimes I want to read, and me, I know coffee does not make me to sleep. So it's the easiest thing for me. Put boil water and get my coffee.
I am more of a tea person. I like it strong and hot, really hot. I enjoy tea with milk.
I'm a coffee person because it helps me stay awake to be able to read.
I'm a coffee person. I can drink 6 cups of coffee a day.
I prefer tea because since my childhood, my father is a tea maker. That's why from my earlier age, I like so much tea.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. A group of women from the Greater Equatoria region are in Wau to train dozens of other women on how to make handcrafts so they can earn a living. 30 young women are learning how to make handbags, wallets, and tablecloths from local materials such as beads. Officials of the Juba-based Women Advance Organization, which organized the training, say they believe the new skills will enable young women to create more jobs and earn income to feed their families. Demo Silva Aurelio has their story for VOA from Wau.
Dozens of women sat on locally made carpets at the Youth and Sports Center in Wau, each holding a needle and spools of threads of different colors, sewing together a variety of handcrafts such as colorful tablecloths. In one corner, a basket was full of items the young women have made by hand, including handbags, wallets, and table mats, all of them ready to be sold in local markets in Wau. The women are expected to spend a month learning new skills. Munira Michael, who has been selling tea in the local market to earn a living, has learned how to make beautiful tablecloths. With a broad smile on her face, Michael says she now has a worthwhile skill to help her earn supplementary income to her tea business. Speaking in Arabic, Michael says, for the last 2 weeks since she learned the new skills and has secured 3 customers who are willing to buy each of her handmade items for 600 South Sudanese pounds. Michael says she's very happy to learn how to make 3 designs of table seats. She says she usually makes them when she gets home from her tea business. Michael says up to 4 customers have come saying they need this or that design. She says it's a good business. Victoria Sote says the products she is learning to make are also friendly to the environment. She says she is encouraging other girls to embrace these new skills and to teach women in their communities how to do the same. She says instead of using plastic material to make bags which harms the environment, women should use bags made from local materials.
It's very economical because if you're going to buy Kabera, you're going to use it for today and tomorrow. And so you cannot go out for places like a charge with Kabera. So instead of having Kabera, you can use this wallet for going out, going to the wedding, because it is also has a fashion.
Efrisha Eliseo Roko is good at knitting wallets. She says after she completes the training, she will mobilize other young women so they can work in a group to produce similar products for sale.
I've learned how to make bag and wallet. And after we have finished with the learning here, I'm going to start my own. For example, making wallet and bags for women. There is a very big difference. Like, you cannot find a wallet made out of beads. You cannot find it easily here, unless you have to import it from Uganda, something of that kind.
It takes an individual 2 days to produce a single handmade tablecloth or handbag. Hosanna Angela Atoroba, who is coordinating the training, says for the last 2 weeks, the women have produced hundreds of items ready to be sold at an exhibition next week.
We are going to like hire a place where we shall be selling the produce or the products. Like the end of, on 6th of this of June is when we are going to make the exhibition, the first product which we have done. We shall sell out the products and the remaining we shall actually open a shop, something like a shop for them.
Hundreds of women in the greater Equatorial region, especially the former Central Equatorial state, are already earning income from making and selling handcrafts. Jospin Ropi, who is now a tutor, learned the skills in 2013 while in Kajokeji County. She says the business has helped her earn a steady income. She says now she can easily afford to pay tuition fees for her 3 children.
The knitting helping women because you are busy, you are leisure time of going somewhere, maybe for rumor mongering. It's not there. You will be busy. Your mind will be peaceful. You are trying to make things good. You are trying to get maybe amount of money. Only you are concentrating on that things. Especially me, for example, when I'm trained there in Kajukechi. I'm busy. I have interest of doing the beads and the tablecloths. Up to now, they will help me. Even I'll pay my children in the school that work.
Ropi says she wants to help provide women with creative skills that will enable them to become self-sufficient and compete in today's changing business environment. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Wau.
Nigerian reporter Isaac Linus Abrok has covered the war with Boko Haram for many years and interviewed some of the young mothers who returned to Maiduguri. VOA's David Arnold asked him about the hardships the girls face when they return home.
At least I've spoken to about 4 of them, very close interviews. Most of them have issues when they come back home. I give you an example. There is a certain Amina. Amina is from Madagali. She escaped from Boko Haram. When she got back home sometimes last year, the community people refused her staying back in the village because they felt that the baby she was carrying in her belly, when she gives birth to the baby, Boko Haram would definitely come for their baby. And in because they will attack the community and kill everybody in the community. So her parents had to keep her hiding. And at the end of the day, she was moved to one of her relations in another village. Another young girl of about 14 years who returned back home, her own biological mother did not want the girl to stay around her house with the Boko Haram baby. So the little girl, the 13-year-old girl, had to go and abandon her baby in a refuge dump. Older woman found the baby here.
It sounds like a problem that doesn't have a solution.
It is not that it does not have a solution, but a solution has not been provided yet.
What kind of help do they need?
These girls are rescued and they are still in camp. It is at that level that the government would identify them, get them out, and give them some psychological rehabilitation, and try and talk to them and get all this trauma off them. Also include the parents and try to educate the society on how to accept these babies, because these babies are just innocent babies. Well, the idea that Boko Haram is going to come back and take away these babies, as far as we can see right now, Boko Haram is on their own. But yet, people are still living in fear.
Has there been any family support of the girls?
I'm in contact with one of the girls who is about 11 years old, and she got pregnant and she was bleeding. When she got back home, the mother took her to various hospitals and she's healed now. When I spoke to her last month, she's about 8 months pregnant. Her mother is caring for her. Some of the girls are lucky to receive family support. But even if her biological father and her biological mother support her, her extended family such as the uncles, the aunties, will not feel very comfortable with having such a girl in the house. So even if they have family support, the extended family normally frowns at them. Generally, these girls are not finding it easy. I have spoken to some of these girls. They are really, really terrified. They are really, really frightened. It would be great if organizations, especially if there are foreign organizations, who can extend a hand of help to these girls, because it is really, really terrible. Some of them still want to go back to school, but yet they have babies to take care of. This is carried out by Boko Haram. They kidnap young girls and get them impregnated so that when these girls give birth to these babies will carry on the war of Boko Haram. These girls and these communities and their parents also live with this fear that Boko Haram will definitely come back someday, trace them someday to take back their babies and indoctrinate them back into their ideology.
That was reporter Isaac Abrak in Abuja speaking with VOA's David Arnold. There are about 60 million refugees worldwide, people who fled to other countries due to conflict, persecution, and human rights violations. A new study says such humanitarian crises have created a health emergency that's gotten little attention. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The study says many refugees need surgery, but it's often neglected in times of crisis. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health estimates at least 2.8 million surgeries a year may be needed among the displaced. Study leader Dr. Adam Kushner explains why the need for surgery may get overlooked.
Part of it is that surgery is not really thought of as part of public health or global health. There's been some movements in the last couple of years to kind of bring that forward. And a bunch of us are trying to say there are a lot of things that go into health needs, but there's also a surgical component. This study was really to kind of highlight that.
He says many refugees most likely need basic surgery.
Things like cesarean section, hernia repairs, appendicitis, also fractures and broken bones. We're not talking the complex transplantation or cardiac surgery here. This is the stuff where a child falls from a tree and breaks a leg. They don't get that leg taken care of, they're casted or splinted, but they may end up being disabled. Treating simple burns or even a cut that might need stitches.
Even when there's no immediate crisis, Kushner says many in developing countries need surgery.
We've done studies in the past in places like Sierra Leone and Nepal and Rwanda, looking at the baseline needs of the population. For example, in Sierra Leone, before Ebola, 25% of the population indicated they had some sort of surgical need. And that's going to be similar in places like Somalia and probably northern Kenya and parts of Ethiopia. And so then you bring in refugees and displaced people on top of that, it's going to cause a lot of problems.
The World Health Organization estimates 15% of pregnant women will suffer from complications that require surgery, such as protracted labor and ectopic pregnancy. The WHO says the prevalence of pregnancy among displaced women of reproductive age is between 6 and 14%. The study says lack of documentation, high costs, and weak infrastructure also contribute to surgery not being done.
I think a lot of people look at surgery and think, oh, that's really expensive, or it's some of the elective stuff that's not needed. But if you just look at what are the minimum basic standards, you just think of a child with appendicitis or an adult with a hernia, If you repair that hernia, their intestines won't get stuck in it. They won't die of bowel problem. They'll be able to work. So there's also the economic benefit of this.
So what can be done?
It is a daunting question. There is a lot of healthcare being given. And so working with governments, with international organizations, groups like MSF, to recognize that there is a surgical burden and that should be addressed when trying to plan and do these interventions. One of the first issues is really to recognize that this is a problem and we should address it.
Dr. Kushner says surgery should go hand in hand with other medical care given to refugees.
What I mean by that is we know that there are a lot of children and women in need, so we need to consider the surgical aspect of pediatric health, of maternal health. There's a lot of effort being done on non-communicable diseases, and so the surgical component of diabetes or cancer, cardiac disease, just adding it as another tool into what's already being done is the way to go about this.
The study was published online May 25th in the World Journal of Surgery. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The World Health Organization's regional director for Africa says West Africa is better prepared to tackle future outbreaks of Ebola. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Machidisa Moeti says Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea are able to respond more quickly to emergencies because of upgrades to their surveillance, laboratory, and healthcare systems. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Machidisa Moeti became head of the WHO's regional office for Africa in February 2015, at the height of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. As the World Health Organization's chief troubleshooter in the region, she says she knew she had to do whatever was necessary to stop the spread of this fatal disease. She tells VOA Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea have greatly improved their ability to respond to Ebola. She says this is demonstrated by the skillful way they are managing to halt the occasional flare-ups of the disease.
They've been able, when they get an unexpected case in these last few months, to being able to respond, detect it relatively early, follow up the contacts, and contain the spread. So for me, that's one of the best outcomes of this tragic situation in West Africa.
But she cautions all the improvements made in infrastructure and response systems and in skills training must be sustained. This, she says, requires the continued support of the international community. Moeti says the funding and expertise that poured into West Africa during the Ebola epidemic must hold.
I'm very hopeful that some of the commitments that were made by the donors during the time when these countries were talking about their recovery actually do materialize, because these will be essential to ensuring that the healthcare workers, the infrastructure, the laboratories, the commodities that are needed to be available on an ongoing basis really are sustained.
The World Health Assembly, which has just wrapped up its annual meeting, has approved reforms of the emergency health system. Moeti praises the underlying agreement by member states to provide the money needed to implement this system. She says the WHO will be in a better position now to head off crises before they become full-blown. This, she says, will prove to be a boon to African countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Seda by JJD Musica.
Evangelio Anno Maria Seda Maluje de
Habibi isim Seda isim sukeli wa usajemi kia jamani igeni kijuba muhabatanina bada bitna
ita kanze milan se
Ya mama
muda
tasabasena
We've been listening to JJD Musica with the song Saida. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you back here tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Mm-hmm.